During biblical times, Judas was a very common name. Jesus had a brother named Judas. Judas was a companion of Paul. In fact, when Paul went to Damascus, the man who hosted him there, his name was Judas. There was a revolutionary in Galilee, and his name was Judas in Acts chapter 5. But today, Judas is not a very common name. You see, it's all because there was another man named Judas in the New Testament. His name was Judas Iscariot. Iscariot wasn't his father's name or his last name. Iscariot means where he is from. He was Judas of Kerioth. Kerioth, a small village about 15 miles south of Hebron. In fact, that made Judas the only disciple who was from Judea that Jesus had. Luke says in chapter 6 and verse 16 of his gospel that Judas became a traitor. In fact, he betrayed Jesus. It's not the normal word, by the way, for betrayed. It's not that kind of word. It means he gave Jesus over. And we know the story all so well. He was known as the son of perdition, which shows the eternal ramifications of the choices that he made. But Judas didn't start out as a traitor. He was one of the 12. But somehow he went from being an apostle to an apostate. George Messenger writes this. He said, Judas was never in tune with Jesus. What is clear is that Judas was self-serving. He was a man who followed Jesus for personal gain by the relationship he had. Not in tune, self-serving, for personal gain. Judas's relationship with Jesus was that of a consumer rather than a follower. Sadly, there's a little of Judas in all of you, including me. And there was even a little of Judas in the other disciples. Open your Bibles to Mark chapter 8. And rarely will you find in the Bible anywhere that in about 6-7 verses, you go from really good news to really bad news. Things that seem like they're going well, and then they really sort of get out of hand. In verse 27, it says, Jesus went out along with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he questioned his disciples, and he said, who do people say that I am? And they told him, saying, well, John the Baptist. And others say you're Elijah, but others, you're one of the prophets. And he continued questioning them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered and said to him, you're the Christ. You're the Messiah. We know in the other accounts that also you're the Son of God. He warned them to tell no one about him at that stage. And then watch what happens. There's the good news. And he began to teach them. He said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and the scribes and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. Wow. They were all excited, you know, when Jesus affirmed, like, hey, you know, I got it right. He's the Messiah. He's the Son of God. Probably feeling pretty good. And Jesus, okay, now I want to teach you something. And I'm going to teach you the way it's going to work. I'm going to be arrested, and then they're going to take and they're going to kill me. And it's like the disciples are like, no, wait. We didn't sign up for that. That's not what we're here for. We don't like that idea. You see, what are they? They're consumers. They wanted Jesus to be what they wanted Jesus to be, just like you often do. I want Jesus to be the way I want Jesus to be. You see, it doesn't fit their agenda. So look what happens. And he was stating the matter plainly. I love that. Matthew said he couldn't have been clearer on this. He said, notice, rejected. He says, killed, and then I will rise. He said it couldn't be clear. He says, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Wow. That word rebuke is almost always the word that Jesus is the one doing the rebuking. He's rebuking you know, the scribes and Pharisees. But here Peter takes him aside and rebukes him. It's a really harsh word. It's sort of like, what are you talking about? There's no way that's going to happen. You see, that doesn't fit our agenda. That's the way a consumer looks at Jesus. It's amazing that he could rebuke him. Well, turning around and seeing his disciples, Jesus wants to make sure they all hear this. He rebukes Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." He says, "For you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's." Let me put it another way. You are not setting your mind on my interests, but yours. Notice how stern the rebuke is. Get behind me, Satan. It couldn't be more embarrassing for Peter than that. The consumer mentality. What is in this for me? You see, how can God or how can Christ meet my agenda? That's kind of what I'm hoping for. Sadly enough, today, there are whole ministries that are dedicated to that proposition, that God exists to support your agenda. And people flock to it. We love this. Now I know what Jesus is for. He's for me to help me fulfill all my dreams. Those are the words of a consumer. Certainly not a follower. In America, it's incredibly rampant. Peter Ward in Christianity Today wrote this: "When we approach Christianity as consumers rather than seeing it as a comprehensive way of life, an interpretive set of beliefs and values as well, Christianity becomes just one more brand we consume, along with Gap, Apple, and Starbucks to express identity. And the demotion of Jesus from Lord to label means to live as a Christian no longer carries an expectation of obedience and good works, but rather the perpetual consumption of Christ. Ultimately, we shouldn't be surprised that American Christianity has succumbed to a pervasive power of consumerism." Alan Wolf, a leading sociologist and the director of the Bossy Center of Religion and American Public Life, has concluded that in the United States, culture has transformed Jesus, as well as all other religions found within these shores. In every aspect of religious life, American faith has met American culture, and American culture has completely triumphed. Consumerism. This idea that we want Jesus what we want him to be, but it's not new, and it's not just in America. Listen as I read from Matthew 19 what Peter says. Peter said to Jesus, "Behold, we have left everything and followed you." And then he says, "Well, what will there be for us? We have left everything and followed you. Now, what do we get?" That's what I want to know. What am I going to get out of this? Those are the words of a consumer. You see, that's what happens when you want to use Christ, in a sense, for your own agenda. It may be pervasive, but it's extremely shallow. When Jesus was arrested and tried and sentenced and executed, all but John unfollowed. We're out of here. That's the way it is with consumerism. That's the way it works. I think there are two different types of consumers among us. There is the minimalist consumer. You probably aren't here this week. You'll be here next week. Okay? That's going to be your big day. You'll be out there, got a new pair of pants on, a new pair of shoes, and you're going to walk into a church, and you're thinking, this is the minimum that God would ever expect of me. If I can just show up on, and maybe two holidays, Christmas and Easter, if I can just show up, then I've got it covered. Whatever bad could happen to me, God will cover it because I've showed up twice. Now, you may wonder, like, does that guy only ever preach on birth and resurrection? Doesn't he ever preach on anything else? Because when you're hearing Christmas and Easter, that's pretty much what you're going to get. That's the minimalist approach. You're just trying to cover yourself up so that if something bad could happen, I just need God here for that. Then there's the sort of maximum consumer. And that is what we end up doing. And by the way, if you want to know if you're a maximum consumer, just really listen to your prayer life. Listen to how you pray. You end up praying constantly for your agenda. It's constantly for you. Lord, I need this to happen. I want this to happen. I need this to happen. I need that to happen. Over and over again, you're going to pray in that way. And as long, Lord, I love you as long as you meet my needs of what I want to have happen in my life. But I want to go back to Judas and wonder about him. What happened to Judas? Well, I think like the other 11, Judas saw Jesus as the Messiah, just as Peter had said. Messiah means king. He's coming back. And he's going to throw the Romans out. And then as the son of David, he is going to set up the Messianic kingdom out of Jerusalem. And all of us who are close to him, you see, all of us who are close to him are really going to get good jobs. By the way, read the Gospels. What happens with the disciples over and over again? Which of us will be the greatest? The night before he was crucified, they were still arguing about that. When the kingdom comes, which one of us are going to be the greatest? I know he's number one, but who's going to be number two? Remember James and John, their own mother came and said, look, when you sit on your throne, I want my boys right beside you. You see, they're going to use Jesus. That's what consumerism does. I know what I want from you, and I want you to deliver what it is that I want from you. I think Judas believed that he was going to throw out the Romans. But then as he went and walked with Jesus for 3.5 years, he saw some things he didn't like. There was a Roman of all kinds, a centurion. And he came up to Jesus, this Jewish rabbi, and he said, can you help me? And Jesus should have pronounced a curse on him or something, and he didn't. Jesus just said, sure, I'd love to help you. What can I do for you? That had to bother Judas. Why is he doing that? The Romans are our enemies. Why would he be nice to the Romans? Then on the other side of the coin, it's just exactly the same way. We all know that the people who are most important, those who sit on Moses' seat, those who are going to tell the whole country that Jesus is the Messiah and make it stick, are the scribes and the Pharisees. They're the priests. You see, we need the temple behind us. And you know what Jesus has been doing for 3.5 years? Every time he meets with those people, he insults them. Every time he's around them, he ends up in conflict. He belittles them in public. How wrong can this be? A man who is nice to a Roman centurion, and yet he is so sharp and degrading to our spiritual leaders. Everything seems to be moving so slow for him. And then I think there's an incident that brings about what I would call the straw that broke the camel's back. And back there, that would even sound better, the straw that broke the camel's back, because obviously they had camels. But go with me to Matthew 26 and verse 6. The context occurs in the first 5 verses. It's the Passion Week. This is the last week before Christ is crucified. In fact, in the first 5 verses, we see something is going on. It says in verse 1, when Jesus had finished all these words, he said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days the Passover is coming and the Son of Man is to be handed over for crucifixion. Notice he tells them once again exactly what's going to happen. He even tells them exactly how he's going to die. And then the chief priest and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas. And they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and to kill him. But they were saying, not during the festival, otherwise a riot might occur among the people. They had a problem. Jesus was so popular that when he's finally here at the Passover with all these tens of thousands of people in Jerusalem, everywhere that Jesus went, he is right in the epicenter of hundreds, if not thousands, of people who want to hear him teach, who want to touch him, who hope to be healed by him. They said, if we go in and arrest him in the middle of all those people will turn on us. Now Matthew goes backward to the previous Saturday. He says, now when Jesus was in Bethany, now that's back to the previous Saturday, the week before the Passion, that Saturday. Now when Jesus was in Bethany, at the home of Simon the leper. Now, by the way, I think he, if you wanted to say it more accurately, when Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon, who was a leper. If Simon was a leper, Jesus might not have any trouble with it, but no one else would go in his house. In fact, if he was a leper, he probably wouldn't be allowed to own a house. But that's what he was. Apparently, Jesus had healed him of leprosy. He is one of the men that was healed by Christ and totally, out of gratitude and love for Christ, invites him into his home. And it says, a woman came to him with an alabaster vial, a very costly perfume. We'll find out in a moment it was nard, but And that would be a vowel that would be about this round at the bottom and then have a real skinny, narrow neck on it because you never wanted more than a few drops to come out. We're going to find out that it was worth a fortune. It was worth 1 year's wages. So whatever your wages are for a year, you get an idea. That's what this cost. And so she has this, and it says that she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. So you see this amazing scene. I couldn't imagine. A drop of this could probably be smelled anywhere in the room. She's pouring it. She obviously probably inherited this. This has so much wealth to it that she would have to be extraordinarily wealthy as a person, or it's part of her inheritance. She's taking it all and she's pouring it on Jesus. But the disciples, and here they are again, they were indignant when they saw this. And they said, why this waste? Indignant. Aga nakteo. Really an interesting word. It's a word that is used for intense grieving. So this wasn't just a little, they were like a person who was intensely grieving. What are you doing? What a waste. These are the disciples. This is a week before the crucifixion. They had spent all this time with Christ and they're still indignant. They said, for this perfume might have been sold for a high price than the money given to the poor. Wow, isn't it great? Those guys always are thinking about other people. But notice, it's the disciples doing this. But you know what it's like in any small group, when a whole small group of people are saying something together, somebody started it. Somebody said it first. Hold your place here because we're coming back, and go with me to John chapter 12. John chapter 12. And now we know who and we know a little more. Verse 1, Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover, that's that Saturday, he came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. And so they made him a supper there. And Martha was serving. So we know Simon the leper and Lazarus and that family are close. Martha was serving, but Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. And Mary then took a pound of very costly perfume, a pure nard, and anointed his feet, the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples who was intending to betray him, said this, why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? Wow, now we know who started this. Judas said, why not? Now remember, he's the right guy because he was the guy they most trusted with money. Could imagine when they had to have a treasurer because people gave them money from time to time and kept all 12 of these guys out on the road for 3.5 years. They say, look, one of the guys is going to have to be the guy who handles the money. We need a treasurer. Now, I don't know what the discussion was like. Someone probably said, well, not Matthew. Okay? He's not going to be the treasurer. Now, who's the most trustworthy guy? Oh, they said Judas. He's the guy. By the way, when Jesus even said in the upper room someone's going to betray him, no one said Judas. In fact, most of the guys, realizing just how shallow they were, said, is it me? You see, it's a different kind of thing. But Judas is the one that says this. Now, notice what John writes. Now, he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And he had the money box. And he used to pilfer what was put into it. Therefore, Jesus said, let her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. He said, for the poor you'll always have, but you'll not always have me. Now I'm going to go back to the Matthew passage. Matthew, again, back where we were, Matthew 26. This is astounding. Judas's personal agenda, his idea as a consumer to use Jesus, was so strong that he could be with Jesus 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3.5 years and still use Jesus to pursue his personal agenda. Look, I got some money I can make here. If she's willing to give this to us, I can make a lot of money off of this. So back here in verse 10 now, Jesus speaks again, a little different but similar. He says, Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. For when she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel was preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will be spoken in memory of her." That's amazing, what I just read, that last verse. You know why? I just spoke it. Now remember, Jesus is the son of a carpenter. He's from Nazareth. He is nobody, and he's kind of from nowhere. He's never been more than 50 miles from the epicenter of where he was born. It's kind of who he is. He doesn't have a passport, all the countries he's visited. No one's ever heard of him. Jesus said, "Oh, by the way, in the future when they tell this story," and where are they going to tell the story? Jesus said, "Oh, they're going to tell the story in the whole world. Everyone in the whole world's going to hear this story. You just heard it today in Louisiana." You see, that's the way it works. Jesus knows exactly what's going on. He knows exactly where it's going to go. And he talks about how great it is what this woman did. You know, when I think about that, I thought how costly this was for her. But what was she really doing? Not just preparing him for burial. Maybe I look at it this way. When we always talk about giving, often what we end up doing is we'll say to people like you, "Oh, here's a need. Would you like to give to meet the need?" And then you'll say, "Well, yeah, okay, I'll give to meet the need." We do that, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's not what this is. She gave as an act of worship. She gave to worship him. She didn't think about the cost. Pure worship here. 1 year's wages. All this perfume. And she gave it that way. To the consumers, especially to Judas, who is a consumer of Christ, this is what he can't stand anymore. This is when he says, "I'm done. I am completely done with this." So this is what happens. "Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priest, and he said, 'What are you willing to give me to betray him to you?'" Literally, it says, "What are you willing to give me to hand him over to you?" The NIV is right there. The idea, what are you willing to give me and I'll hand him over to you? See, the problem they had was, we can't get near him. He says, "Yeah, but I'm one of the inner sanctum. I'm one of the 12. I know when there'll be no one else around them. No crowds, and I know right where he'll be." He said, "Now you're going to have to really be prepared for this. You're probably going to have the temple guard and swords and torches, but I can lead you to him. I can get him." That's what he is saying. He said, "What are you willing to give me to hand him over to you?" Do you realize how absurd that is? But that shows you, when you have a consuming mentality, you're only consumed, by the way, with yourself. That's how you see your faith. Judas says, I can hand him over to you. No, really? Judas can hand him over? Let's see. How many times in all the Gospels was it said that they ran to seize Jesus, to grab him, to arrest him, and it says, and he disappeared out of their midst? Often. Now, by the way, and this is Jesus. I mean, think of this. Jesus is a guy, he spoke to the weather. Who does that? He said, "Be still." And a storm becomes completely calm. This is Jesus. This is Jesus. A man is dead for 4 days and says, "Lazarus, come forth." He had seen that. He saw a dead man come forward. This is Jesus. You see, this is Jesus who said, "Oh, you're blind. Oh, I can help you. Give me some mud and I'll pack it on your eye." And he could see. This is Jesus where the lame walked. You see, this is Jesus who fed 5,000. This is Jesus who walked on water. And he says, "I can hand him over to you. I can do that." The arrogance of a consuming mentality, that's what he says. Then we see this. He says, "And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him." And he says, "And from then on, he began looking for a good opportunity to betray Jesus." He's got his 30 pieces of silver. Now, let's go to chapter 27 and verse 1 of Matthew. "Now, when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders and the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him, and they led him away, and they delivered him to Pilate, the governor. Judas never expected this. That's not what Judas was in for. Judas thought, look, the religious leaders need to get control of him. He's not been very favorable to them at all. But they can't do too much harm to him. The Jews have no authority to execute anybody. They really can't execute anybody. He didn't expect that. And by the way, he knew all the leaders of the temple and hated the Romans. So they'd never work in some kind of a conspiracy with the Romans. But it turns out that's exactly what happened. Now notice verse 3, then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse. And he returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. This is not what I bargained for. The Romans can crucify him. Then he said this, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. This is not worthy of a Roman crucifixion. But they, the leaders of the temple, said to him, what is that to us? See to that yourself. And so he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed. And he went away and he hanged himself. Wow. What a terrible, horrible ending to this. He hanged himself. He felt remorse. You know what? There are some decisions that can never be unmade. You just have to face the consequences of what you decided to do. What's interesting to me is that he didn't even want the money anymore. You thought maybe he said, oh, that's just terrible, but he would have pocketed the money. He is filled with remorse. You see, he learned a lesson, a very hard way that you and I can learn without doing this. He learned this lesson, and it's the lesson of the morning for us. God's hand cannot be forced, and God's will cannot be thwarted. God's hand cannot be forced, and his will cannot be thwarted. When you have a consuming mentality about Jesus in your life, that's what you're always trying to do. What you end up doing is you're always figuring a way that I can force the hand of God into a situation, or I can take his will and I can thwart his will. That's what we end up doing, and it shows up so often in our prayer. You see, it shows up that way. Yes, we can pray for our humanity. That's not the problem. We can pray what we feel. The real question comes down to, how do you react when God doesn't give you what you want? You see what so many of us do? We just push him aside. You see, we say, well, what's the point? You ever do that? What's the point? What's the point of me praying? What's the point? I mean, if God isn't going to deliver on my agenda, what's the point of all this? He'll never deliver on your agenda. If it ever turns out that way, it's a coincidence. God's hand cannot be forced and his will cannot be thwarted. Now, you got to love religion in verse 6. The chief priest took the pieces of silver and they said this, it's not lawful to put them into the temple treasury since it's the price of blood. And they conferred together and with the money bought a potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Those are people who came into Jerusalem from all over the world for the festivals and died in Jerusalem. We have a place now to bury them. It says, for this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day, Matthew writes. Now, here's what I say, you got to love religion. First of all, there's nothing in the Old Testament that says you can't do that. So it's not a biblical law. It's a law they made up. It's a tiny little law that's attached to another tiny little law they made up. And they said, look, we want to be right with the law, so I don't think we can take the money now because that blood money's been in the sanctuary, so we have to keep it away from the temple. Now, these are the same people that arrested Jesus by night, illegal. Put Jesus through one trial after another, all the trials illegal. And then they went and paid witnesses to give false testimony, to lie, which is illegal and immoral. But they say, you know, we got to keep the law. We got to be careful with this money. We don't want the money to touch. Isn't that religion? You see, religion misses the beam in its own eye and looks for the gnat. I mean, it's amazing when you think about how they said, we want to stay right with the law. I love what Matthew writes. He says, for this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Hey, it's 25 years later. If you come, I'll show you the field. You'll see the actual field where this really happened. He said, by the way, if you're interested, I could show you an empty tomb. And that would maybe be a little important than the field to see. Then verse 9. Then that which was spoken of through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. As they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel. And they gave them, he says, for the potter's field, as the Lord, he says, directed me. That's an allusion, by the way, to Jeremiah. He is considered the lead prophet by the Jews, not Isaiah. And the quote actually comes more out of Zechariah. So he says, oh, by the way, and it was 500 years before Christ. There's something there when you think about it. Judas was so unhappy because Jesus wouldn't meet his agenda, that Jesus wouldn't be part of his plan of how he saw his life turning out. So Judas ends up betraying Christ, and he really feels terrible for it, and he commits suicide. But isn't it kind of interesting that all Judas became was an instrument in God's hands? 500 years before it happened, God said that there'd be someone who betrayed him, and it would be the 30 pieces of silver, and it would be used to buy a potter's field. You see, that's the point. God's hand cannot be forced, and his will cannot be thwarted. As long as you're a consumer trying to get the Lord to help you with your agenda, you'll never be a follower of Christ. You see, that's what it comes down to. Because when he doesn't do what you want him to do, you'll betray him by doing two things, pushing him away, or what most of you do, pressing on with your own agenda. Examples. You'll marry the unbeliever. You will. Now, you know what the Lord's will is. Yeah, I know, but they might convert later. You see, and I know there are a lot of believers out there, but none of them quite as cute as this girl. And you'll marry her. Why? Because this is my agenda. Then you'll pray every day that God makes sure this person gets saved. And if that person doesn't and your life goes in ruin, then you'll blame the Lord. That's what consumers do. You'll close that deal that you know is unethical, but it'll be for the good of the company and supporting your family. You'll make an investment in something that you know Christ would never approve of, but it's business. You'll refuse to move. The Lord will give you an opportunity, but you'll refuse to move. You won't go to another city. You won't go to another state. You won't go anywhere. I was wondering, by the way, if you want to know if you were a consumer or a follower, if you were actually thinking about the words you were singing when we were singing the song, I will follow wherever you lead me, all over the world, I will follow. What were you really thinking? That you would follow? Or you'd say, I'm not really going to follow. That's right. That's what a consumer would say. I'm not really going to follow. You see, if your leading's leading me somewhere else, I'm not really going to. I have my agenda. Jesus said, I'm baffled by it. Why do you call me Lord then? Not do the things that I ask. But whenever you stop being a consumer and start being a follower of Christ, I can tell you something. It'll be the defining moment of your life. It'll be more than anything. What's that mean? Well, that would mean this. Lord, anything, anytime, anywhere, at any cost. That'd be your mantra. Anything. You just ask me what you want, I'll be there. You see, it sounds sort of like this. When you are a follower of Christ, you say, I want what you want more than what I want. That's what a follower does. I want what you want more than what I want. And the consequences of this are astounding. When you are a follower of Christ, you could be a young doctor with a promising career, a graduate of Tulane Medical, and you might find yourself in the Congo for your life. Because that's what followers do. No agenda. Not, I need Jesus in my life like a lucky rabbit's foot to pursue my own agenda. Marriages that are heading for divorce might actually be healed. Forgiveness may be offered because it's the will of the Lord. Career paths may change. Ministries to the needy may be pursued because you've been exposed to it. Lord, I'll use my resources the best I can. Even your giving will become a joyful experience rather than a sacrificial exercise of your will. You see, one thing I want you to remember is this. Jesus didn't stop Judas from doing what he wanted to do. And he won't stop you either. Jesus didn't stop Judas. By the way, something you have to know, though, Judas didn't stop Jesus from doing what he intended to do either, because you never will. God's hand cannot be forced. His will cannot be thwarted. Try to wake up every morning and say, Lord, today, I want what you want more than what I want. And by the way, if you're kind of an in-betweener, which many of you probably are, consumer, follower, you're an in-betweener, how about this prayer then? Lord, I want to want what you want more than what I want. Because at least that's a beginning. The consumer will never pray that prayer, only the follower. But you know, if Judas Iscariot had prayed that prayer, we might be naming our little boys Judas. Let's pray. Father, I think the most difficult thing about being a consumer of Christ rather than a follower of Christ is we just don't see it. It's obvious to Christ, and sometimes it's obvious even to others, but to ourselves, we are so bound in our own agenda that we want you so much to fulfill all of the dreams and aspirations that we have. And then we ask your blessing on everything that we do, whether it's your will or not your will. Father, I would pray that we would, as the disciples eventually did, stopped being consumers and they became followers. Those 11 men changed the world because they gave up their agenda and they simply followed yours. Father, that's my prayer for each and every one of us. We say so often here that we want to help people become fully functioning followers of Christ, but that requires them to follow and not to consume. Father, we pray that this day, for some of them, it would become the defining moment of their life. In Jesus' name, for your glory and for our good, amen.